You're listening to Something Beautiful, part of the Emergent Podcast Network. For more information about this and other great shows, visit us online at www.emergentpodcast.com.
All right. Well, on the phone with us tonight from Plymouth, Minnesota, we have Frank Schutzwall, a.k.a. Trucker Frank, former pastor, turned trucker. He's actually at the dock getting ready to unload, but he's spending some time with us this evening on the Something Beautiful podcast. Frank, glad to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
Now, you are a truck driver. You were saying that you're basically kind of there for the night to undock or to unload and get ready to pull some more, another load in the morning. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. In the morning, I'm going to go down to a place called Blue Earth, Minnesota, where they have a 50-foot statue of the Jolly Green Giant.
Excellent.
And I'm hauling probably a load of vegetables down to the Aldi's distribution center on the Olathe, Kansas. It'd be on the Kansas City side.
Okay.
Of the metropolitan area down there. So
now,
that's my day, and that's my pretty much be the end and come back up Sunday
night. Okay, and you were saying that you're from Maysville, Missouri, is that right?
Maysville, Missouri is where I live, about 60 miles north of Kansas City. It's a little town kind of in the middle of nowhere, maybe about 1,500 people or so. So it's a good place to kind of hide out and sort of a Nazareth, I guess, of Missouri.
Okay. Now, do you truck, I guess, all over the country, or do you have kind of a specific area or region that you kind of stay in?
I used to run all over the United States pretty much, except for, you know, Alaska and Hawaii. But now I am pretty much, they call them dedicated runs. I pick up at W.W. Granger, which is an industrial hardware supplier, and run from the distribution center there in Kansas City up here to Plymouth, Minnesota. And then here in Plymouth, they distribute it to all over the Twin Cities, up to Duluth, over to St. Cloud, pretty much this general area here. Two, three trips up a week, depending on what week it is. I and another driver alternate, and so it's kind of nice because I have a pretty good idea than what I'm going to be doing on any given week, and it kind of gives a little more stability, whereas the regular over-the-road truck drivers, they are going to have more of a up-in-the-air type thing. You know, they don't know where they're going to be from day to day.
Now, so how long?
It's kind of nice.
How long have you been in the trucking business?
Pretty close to 20 years now.
Okay.
I started into it right, you know, during my divorce and actually leaving the church for one of the many times that, you know, I've left the institutional church. So it's been about 20 years.
Okay. Now, you mentioned leaving the institutional church. You have a very unique story. You are a former pastor turned truck driver.
Yes.
That's maybe not something that we're accustomed to. We may see truck drivers become pastors, but usually it's not the reverse. What originally got you into the quote-unquote institutional ministry?
Well, when I was, first of all, when I came over, I'm an immigrant, naturalized citizen. My parents moved to the United States, and I lived in Grants Pass, Oregon for most of my, you know, high school years. When I was 16 years old, a friend of mine, who is now a missionary in North Africa, one day we were watching in class, I think one of the James Fenimore Cooper films, Deer Slayer or Pathfinder, and he was sitting next to me, and just out of the blue, he asked me, he said, "Frank, are you saved?" And although I didn't have any idea what it was, I knew it had something to do with religion, and so, of course, the proper answer was yes, because I figured that would get him off my back. But he continued, and he said, "Well, when did you get saved?" And I didn't have an answer for that one, so I just blundered out, basically, "Well, I prayed one time, and God answered my prayer." Well, he gave me a little booklet, which had some scripture verses in it. I went home, read them, went to a Bible study, I believe that Tuesday night, that this little independent fundamental church, Bible church had. And at the end of the Bible study, they asked if anyone would like to, pray the sinner's prayer, as it's traditionally called. And so I prayed and, asked Christ to forgive my sins. And that following Sunday, I went down the aisle of the church to, let people know what I had done and all of that. And that was kind of the start of it.
Mm-hmm.
So in high school, I took speech and debate, and so I was immediately pegged to be the sort of person that might end up being a great future preacher, and so it was kind of assumed that that's what I would do. And so, I was kind of groomed in the youth group. I would go to rescue missions, and I would preach there. That was an interesting experience, a high school kid of 17 trying to, talk to people that had probably seen more of life than I would ever see, mm-hmm. especially the dark side. And it was an interesting experience. After that, I went to Campus Crusade for Christ. They had down in San Bernardino, they had a kind of a summer institute of biblical studies, and I got to hear the likes of Howard Hendricks from Dallas, and also got to hear Hal Lindsey. Hal Lindsey was quite the rage at that time, late great Planet Earth. Mm-hmm. We were all ready to be raptured out of here, and so which fit into my theology real well. But strange things happened down there in Southern California. I went down, I remember looking at pictures, I went down and I had like this horrible double-breasted suit that I would wear. And I came back pretty much in flip-flops, with a tie-dye shirt, and I looked like a hippie coming back because it was the 1968-69 was the height of this. And I met some very interesting Jesus people down mm-hmm. there, and was absolutely blown out of the water by their love, their sincerity, just their overall attitude. So I came back, grew my hair long, wore a headband, and of course got the severe scorn of my pastor. And then it was off to college, and I picked, because I didn't want to go to a straight Bible college, I went to Seattle Pacific University, and went my freshman year there, and got up there and found that I was the resident conservative, transferred over my sophomore year to Western Baptist Bible College in Salem, Oregon, which is now, I think, called Corbin College, and graduated in 72, and I went from there, I was the resident liberal, but backwards. In Seattle Pacific, I was the conservative at the Western. Yeah, I was the liberal.
Okay.
So I guess I did have it right. But that was basically it. And, I ended up marrying a gal from the youth group, and we just started out in small churches, and I just knew that was where I was supposed to be. Because mm-hmm. everybody told me that was where I was supposed to be.
Okay.
So that's how I got into the ministry.
So you had more, it was more of a confirmation, I guess, from other people versus maybe something that you just felt a stirring in your soul?
Yes, pretty much. I think it was more of a, that this was the sort of thing, I trusted other people who had been in it longer, and, of course, my assumption was, if someone has been a Christian for a long time, then they have a pretty good idea of what's going on, and it was all still pretty new to me. Although I did start studying the Bible and reading it and devouring it, and I became very interested in history, and I had one professor at Western Baptist who got me hooked on archaeology and Israel. And so in college, I had a pretty good idea that, I was going to come in and shake the world up and shake the church up, and there was nothing that was going to stop me. So mm-hmm. that's the attitude and the frame of mind I entered the ministry with.
Okay. Now, you mentioned you came over as an immigrant with your parents. Were they supportive of this yeah. move into ministry? Is that something that they felt like you were called to, or was this foreign to them?
Pretty much foreign to them, because over in Germany, a lot of the cities and towns over there, one will be predominantly Catholic, the other one will be predominantly Lutheran or Evangelisch, as they say in German. And, of course, I grew up in was born in a Catholic town. So As an infant, I was baptized. Never went to Catholic Church, though. They never forced me to go.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when I came here, my mother naturally assumed that in Germany I would have been a Catholic, and since I'm over here, I'm a Protestant because that's what most of the people are over here. So she just, although she didn't care, neither one of them cared for it. Dad was pretty well neutral. You know, he was pretty supportive of whatever I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was just sort of the thing, you know, you're in the United States and, you know, you're going to be a Protestant. That's their viewpoint that they had. So,
okay.
Rather interesting.
Now, going into the ministry, I guess if this wasn't a particular call of yours, I mean, that you felt like stirring in your heart or anything, and did you struggle with that starting out? Was that something that you thought, you know, maybe I'm not cut out for this, maybe these people are wrong, or did you just, was it just such a natural fit that you just knew this is where you were supposed to be?
I thoroughly loved it. I mean, I loved, you know, studying. I loved what I was reading in the Word. I loved the stories in the Scriptures. And I just thought, man, this is great. You know, this is the sort of thing that I would love to do to impact people, to make a change, because this is all about loving people and growing together and working together in unity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I read Ephesians chapter 4, it was like, wow, you know, this is fantastic. This is what I would really like to do, to have this kind of an impact. Of course, I was taught that Ephesians 4:13, where we all attain the unity of the faith, that was something that was unattainable in this life. It was rather something that would happen at the end when Christ returns.
Hmm.
And, you know, since then, of course, I've through studying and reading it, I found out that that's not the case at all. I've come to an opposite conclusion. We've kind of shoved it off as this is something that we can't get to, and so therefore no, we're not even going to try.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the rapture fervor, thanks to, you know, the late great planet Earth, most people thought, well, we haven't got much time, so, you know, we just need to get out there and witness to as many people as possible, and then, you know, sit in church and wait for it to happen. And unfortunately, that attitude, I think, still carries over today.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, and then I think McLaren kind of points out couple of his books, it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you believe that,
yes,
you know, that the world, yes, is going to come to an end soon and there's not much we can do, then naturally we're not going to do anything and the world's just going to come to an end.
Absolutely. Kind of a fatalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some of the hymns that, you know, I learned, this attitude, I think, was from Hold the Fort, for I Am Coming. You know, kind of like we're hemmed in a corner. The enemy is on all sides, and we're waiting for the cavalry, not the cavalry, little pun there.
Mm-hmm.
We're waiting for the cavalry to come and rescue us from all this, you know, and get us out of this evil world. And, boy, I'll tell you what, when I did finally leave the ministry and jump behind the wheel of a truck, which is something I hated and did not want to do because it was like sending someone out into the worst possible world that you could imagine. I mean, here was the powers of darkness, you know, were loose, and it was like leaving the presence of God to go out into the world. And I had quite a turnaround when I got out there and found out that that wasn't the case at all.
Hmm. So as you're pastoring churches, and I'm not sure exactly how many along the way, but at what point does this inner struggle start, I don't want to say overtaking you, but when does this really begin and you start really questioning these things?
I was at a small ex-Presbyterian church when I was still in college at Western getting my degree. And it was fantastic because newly married, we just had a baby. My first daughter, well, my only daughter, was born. We were in this small town. Started out with just a couple of people, and it just grew. We developed relationships in the community with younger couples. We found couples coming in, and I mean, it was body life. It was a relational type of a thing. It was just fantastic. It didn't pay a lot, and so we were struggling financially. I remember we had to take food stamps in order to actually get enough to eat, mm-hmm. you know, and provide for the family. But I was at that that little church for a long time, and it grew. It was fantastic. And then came the offer from this large Mennonite church in Salem, Oregon. That was, I know it sounds strange being Mennonite in, you know, my background, but really in practice, I guess you could say they were kind of very Baptistic. They were more the modern Mennonites, not the old order.
Mm-hmm.
And very prosperous. On the east part of Salem, they had a huge, huge building. It looked like the Starship Enterprise had landed in the farm fields. I mean, right in the middle of nowhere, all these farm fields with this huge building, a six-bedroom parsonage, brick parsonage. You know, I guess they wanted us to have a lot of kids. And, I mean, this was unbelievable. And I went and I gave my best, you know, positive message sermon that I could, because I really wanted to get in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we got called. We were accepted, and we moved in there. This was the kind of church that they had an assistant pastor, and I came in as a senior pastor, although the assistant pastor at the time was a year older than I was. What they would do, they had an interesting habit. They would, when they brought in a new senior pastor, they'd get rid of the youth and associate pastor, bring a new associate pastor, and then get rid of the senior pastor, back and forth. Well, while I was there, I ran into some of the, I guess you'd say, the outcasts from that particular church who were more of a Mennonite frame of mind. They were pacifist. They believed in community. All of the things that I think make the Anabaptist and the Mennonite tradition so, you know, strong, the sense of community, which, oddly enough, the church didn't have. Well, I started hanging out with them, and pretty soon I got very frustrated with, because I saw the outcasts were the ones who were living biblically, and the ones who were on the inside of the church were the ones that were actually so institutional and traditional and dead, and I mean, they had this 300-seat sanctuary with maybe 150 people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized then that something was going on here, and I served there 1 year, was voted in for a second two-year term. They're kind of like running for office in that particular setting.
Did you have little you know, Frank for Pastor buttons?
No. By the second time, I think I was just glad to get out of there without being lynched or assassinated. But after the first year of that second, that two-year term, I got bold and I got disgusted with what I was seeing, and I thought, you know, I need to keep emphasizing what is in the scriptures, what I believe, and not go with the flow. They wanted somebody to come in and just basically, you know, preach good messages and visit the sick and just do all the right things. That, by the way, if you've watched the videos with Tony, that was the potted plant church.
Okay. Now, for those that are unfamiliar, just kind of touch on that. What happened? What's the potted plant story?
Well, there was this potted plant that sat up there on the stage, and I looked at that thing one day, and I thought, you know, that is so typical of what this church is like. It looks good, but it's dead, lifeless. Mm-hmm. And I told Ellen, my wife, I said, you know, this just reminds me of this church, dead and lifeless. And she just kind of chuckled a little bit. I can't remember what her reaction was. But that particular Sunday, I was up there and I was preaching, and I stopped preaching and I walked over and picked this potted plant up and put it right there on the pulpit. And I could see her face. I mean, it was like this look of terror in her eyes. And she was like, oh, no, he's going to do it. You know, and I started, although it wasn't quite as pointed as it may have come across in Tony's videos, I basically indicated that, kind of around the back door, that they were basically this potted plant. And then I just kind of just pushed the potted plant aside, just almost threw it on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the look on my wife's face was I wish I would have had a video camera. It's priceless. She was like, going, well, okay, we're going to be moving again. We're going to be looking for another house and, you know, another job, which is exactly what happened. The ultimate, I was reading the qualifications of pastors and deacons one time out of Timothy, and one of the deacons slammed his Bible shut because all I was doing was reading the scripture, and he was upset over that.
Mm-hmm.
They had a meeting, and they got me out of the pulpit so fast, they said, we'll give you 3 months' salary, you can live in the parsonage, but don't you set foot in the church.
Wow.
So there I sat. Every Sunday morning I would go out and drink my coffee, sit there and look at the Starship Enterprise and watch people come in and wave at them, you know, getting paid, you know, and not having to do a thing. So that was fantastic. It was great.
Now, how did the rest
of the eventually?
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, how did the rest of the church respond to this? I mean, were they in agreeing with these deacons, or was this, I mean, were they shocked by it and, you know, felt sorry for you, or were they... What was the response?
I would say the supporters kept their mouth shut. The new youth minister that came in, because the other one that was there when I got there, of course, they got rid of him immediately when I got there. And the new guy, he was so concerned about keeping his job that, you know, he didn't really voice his opinion. We had a lot of friends, and they just basically wouldn't say anything about the whole situation. We sometimes would call each other privately, but I think they were afraid to be associated mm-hmm. with me. Except for the janitor, the custodian. He was really nice, friendly. We got along great, younger guy. And he didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he called him, well, we won't avoid that, but anyway. So then I left, and we managed departments for a while, many warehouses. I became a carpenter. I learned how to build cabinets for a construction company. And then when the building industry went belly up, we ended up moving to Missouri because that's where my wife's parents were from. And so we went there, and I got a job substitute teaching in the school district there in Maysville, drove a school bus. At one point, I was working at a service station also, you know, just so we could get enough money to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody found out that I used to be a pastor. And first, the Christian church called us to come in and candidate. And by that time, we had bought a house in town. And I candidated. I gave a couple of sermons. And I did my best positive you know, I think I even had the right inflection for Bob Schuller, because I figured that's what they wanted to hear. And sure enough, they showed up and said, you know, we've got this nice parsonage on the better part of town, you know, the single level ranch style, good salary. But basically they said, we want an accounting of everything you do 24/7.
Well,
and they were in my living room, and I looked at them, and I said, well, thank you. Great. I'll get back to you. They walked out the door, and I looked at Ellen, and I said, no, not doing it. And I called them up, and I said, thanks, but no thanks. And at the same time, this little Baptist church about 13 miles north offered us $70 a week to come up and pastor, and that's what we did. We went to the, you know, the little Southern Baptist church up there. But it was fantastic because, again, they were more of the relational type mm-hmm. of church. We got to know the people very well, and it was fantastic. I was there for 6 years. I think at that time that was a record for pastors that they had. Got to establish some lifelong friendships, and unfortunately, it was at that time that one of my jobs, I injured my back and became a very difficult person to live mm-hmm. with. And I think my wife finally came to the realization that this guy is a loser. He's never going to amount to anything. And she was right. I look back on the situation, and I admire her. she deserves sainthood for putting up with me as long as she did.
Mm-hmm.
And the pressure of being a pastor, I think that is the thing that finally took its toll. The constant expectation that your family is supposed to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You can't show any weaknesses. You have to always show up with a smile on your face no matter what happened. And I just took it out on my family.
Mm.
All the frustration I was feeling, the pressure, I took it out on them. And my wife eventually, you know, made the decision. She said, I can't handle living with you anymore. And, of course, put me into a depression, a couple of suicide attempts. And the last one swallowed a bunch of pills. And it was almost humorous later on when I found out what happened, because I had traveled out to the state of Oregon looking for work. I didn't know what to do. Came back. I had been in training to become a truck driver. The person that my wife eventually hooked up with was the bus manager, and he cut one of my bus routes and suggested that I go into truck driving. And that's where I went and took my training then, because I had no other option, really.
Mm-hmm.
Hated it. Absolutely hated driving, hated not being at home, and decided to quit, come back home, and that was when she informed me that she wanted a divorce. And, you know, it wasn't just a, I don't want to be around you for a while, I don't want to be around you, period. And that was what set the real depression. So I stayed with in a camping trailer in a farmyard with one of the deacons of the Baptist church where I used to pastor. I resigned my pastorship because I just figured it would be a lot easier for the congregation,
mm-hmm.
To, rather than try to take sides, it would be better if I quit than to put them through that that turmoil. So came a crisis point. The day that I actually received the divorce papers is what put me over the edge. And one of the many jobs that we were doing to stay afloat and make ends meet was we worked at the doctor's office there in town, and I absconded with some central nervous system depressants, carried them around with me, anticipating that I might need to use them sometime. And so there in the camping trailer, I swallowed 40 of them.
Wow.
Put myself in a coma. And the funny thing is, as I think about it now, I would have loved to, I hope one day God shows me a video of this, because I can just imagine what it looked like. I must have walked out of the camping trailer, out of the barnyard, the farmyard, through a couple of fences, into the house of the deacon, down the stairs, opened the freezer downstairs, came back up, and put a package of chicken McNuggets in front of the microwave and collapsed on the kitchen floor. I must have looked like a zombie from, you know, Dawn of the Dead, mm-hmm. walking out there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like God was taking me like a puppet. Now, I don't know why he added the going down the stairs and, you know, getting the McNuggets out of the freezer, why he added that part in. I guess he has a sense of humor. But my daughter's best friend, who was the daughter of the deacon, came home and found me lying there on the floor. They rushed me to the hospital, pumped my stomach, and I think 2 weeks later I came to in a hospital and realized that, well, I guess this isn't the end. there's something else for me. But throughout the entire experience, I never once, you know, hated God or resented him. I just felt that it would be better if I left.
Hmm.
So that was kind of the dark time, the real dark time of the soul. And then after that, when I got out of the hospital, I went back and thought, well, I know how to drive a truck, so that's what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you're mid to late 30s at this point?
Let's see. Yep, mid to late 30s.
So
it'd be about the right time.
So you've trained, you know, you've gone to school to be a pastor. You've had people tell you that this is your calling. It's something that you enjoy. You feel of course, like you mentioned, this dark side, this depression. You've attempted suicide and so forth, and went into trucking. I mean, what's going through your mind as you get back in that truck and start driving again?
It was almost as if when I woke up in the hospital, I was starting a totally different life. It was like everything had cleared, and I was looking at something completely different, and I had no preconceived ideas. I mean, I didn't have much choice in the matter. So I went out, and I started driving, and pretty well dealt with all the demons that I was battling. The truck was good therapy. Going down the road, I had time to rethink all of the things that happened, and there was a purging and there was a cleansing. And although I still believed in God, believed in Christ, I wanted to have nothing to do with the church of any kind, because I felt that it was a bad experience, and the last thing I wanted to do is go back into that situation again.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out, and it was while I was out on the road the second time, or I should say now, it's been from then until now, I began to realize that the God that I was serving when I was in church was a God that I viewed as basically being in the building 1 hour a week, and then the rest of the time we kind of lock him up, we leave, and then we can call on him when we need him and get him out of the building again. We spring him out of his trap, and then we put him back when we're done with him. But I began to realize as I looked around me, as I met people who in this evil, dark world were supposed to be people that I was supposed to be afraid of, people that I was supposed to avoid, were actually people that were seeking for God, and many of them had a tremendous love for God and a relationship with God that I envied. It was a personal relationship that I didn't have completely. It was a day-to-day type of experience, and drivers and stories out there. I've listened to a couple of your podcasts, and I know you're about sharing stories with people, but my word, the stories that I saw on the road and the things that God did in some of the places you would never expect, and I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but I mean, I went to the brothels. I was driving for a company, got down to the Mexican border, a lot of Laredo, and I don't know if you know, living in Texas, you probably know about Nuevo Laredo across the border.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite common. Prostitution is legal, and I mean, there would be many times that I would go over there and come back and, you know, sleep off my hangover in the lot of the company I was driving for. But what really shook me up, one experience, a driver, and I wish I still stayed in contact with him, he went over with me, and Saturday night we went over there and we partied, we drank, and, you know, don't need to go into details
sure.
What other things we did. But we came back, and I slept, and Sunday morning I walked in, and here was, everybody called him Bing. He looked like a cross between Howard Stern and Frank Zappa, if you remember who that is.
Right.
Tall guy, ex-Special Forces military guy, long, wavy black hair, hooked nose, and he had this gigantic King James Bible open on the table. And I walked in, and I go, Bing? I said, you're a Christian? He goes, yes, I am. And I said, well, tell me about it. What's going on here? He said, I kind of had a loose relationship with God. And he said, then one day, he said, I came home. I had been gone for a while. He said, I came home and I found my wife and 12-year-old daughter had been raped and murdered in my house. And I walked in on it. And I was just stunned. And he said, all I could do, he said, you would think I would hate God. But he said, I just ran to God. It was all I could do. And he said, I realized then, he said, that I went to the trial of the guy that did it. They caught him. And he said, the whole time, he said, I was expecting, trying to work up hate for this guy. And he said, all I could do was look at him and realize that, you know, he was a person that needed the love of Christ as much as I did. And I'm sitting there listening, and there were other drivers that had gathered around by then. And we were just sitting there listening to him, and as he talked out of the this large King James Bible, he not only read about grace to us, he showed us grace in his life. Mm-hmm. How that he could find forgiveness in his heart for what that man had done to his family. And then to realize that that same forgiveness extended to him and to all of us. It was a life-changing experience for me.
Wow.
And I realized that you can't always judge the depth of spirituality by a person, by the doctrines they believe, by the way they dress, by where they've gone to school, or any of that. It has to do with how much of a relationship they have established with the Father, with Allah.
Mm-hmm.
And story after story out there on the road of things that have happened, and it has made me realize that one of the really sad things that is happening in the institutional church today is we have one man every Sunday telling everybody else, interpreting the Bible for them, but sitting in the pews are hundreds of thousands of stories that people never get to hear just because of the way we run church. And I'm convinced that the more we allow people to open up and to share their life, the more the body of Christ will grow, strengthen, and mature.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in most institutional settings, when a person reveals a weakness, it's like throwing blood in the water to a bunch of sharks. And I think the reason that is they attack that person because it gets the attention away from them. If we can put it all on that person, then maybe people won't find out about me and the way that I live. And it is so sad to see that happen.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what occurs. So as a result, I don't think Jonathan and hi, Thomas, if you're listening, by the way, I enjoy your input. I don't think I can ever go into an institutional church again in the capacity of a pastor or whatever. I guess for want of a better word, the small group that I meet with, we call ourselves free-range Christians, and we liken it to like wild horses out there.
I was thinking free-range chicken, so that's the first thing that came to my mind.
Free-range chickens, yeah. Well, chickens just doesn't paint a noble image, you know. and Jesus used the image of sheep, and that, you know, free-range sheep just doesn't cut it either. But I just got to thinking about it. You know, when horses are corralled, it's taking a beautiful animal and just kind of limiting its abilities. And I think that's what happens to Christians in the church. We limit their abilities by putting them in situations where they cannot open and share. And thank God for the institutional churches that do allow their people to share. And I'm not just talking about passing out a bulletin or things like that. I'm talking about actually letting them share their faith and their life and their stories. But anyway, you know, I kind of visualize the institutional church as being a bunch of horses in a pen, and then along comes this wild Mustang running by, and they're all going, "What's he doing out there?"
Mm-hmm.
And thinking, "Well, I'm glad I'm not out there because it's dangerous out there." We get our food every Sunday, and we're taken care of, we're protected, and that person has got nothing, or that horse has got nothing. Well, the free-range horses, eventually they end up getting together, and they have sort of a loose-knit community and leadership, but they find pasture out in an area. The entire world is open to them.
Hmm.
And I think there's something about us that resents that. So free-range Christians, I've been listening to a lot of, free rangers out there who are gradually, we're coming together, we're realizing we're out there. And we are not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together just because we don't pack our bodies into a pew on any given Sunday. I think the simplest definition of church is the one that I think it was Thomas shared on one of your podcasts, and I felt this way for a long time. That was when Jesus said, where two or three are gathered together, there I am. That mm-hmm. is church. That is church functioning. It can happen several times a week. And the beauty of it is, and this is what scares so many people in the institutional church, they automatically think if you leave the institution, you're going to fall into all kinds of error because you have no leadership. Well, they forget that we still have leadership. We're relying upon the leadership of the shepherd, mm-hmm. the main shepherd, that's Jesus Christ. And using the wild Mustang analogy, one of my favorite movies, The Lord of the Rings, I just remember that scene. And I actually teared up when Gandalf saw Shadowfax, the king of the horses, for the first time. And I thought, that's Jesus Christ right there.
Right.
Jesus Christ is the wild stallion that is the leader of all the others. And he's saying, come, follow me. Come into a wide open world. Don't just be penned up. Don't listen to, you know, someone that is, just because you have food and security doesn't mean that when you follow me, you're going to lose all those things. And just the Christ taking his followers into the fields and teaching them, I thought, wow, that is church happening right there. Go ahead.
An awesome imagery of what the church can become and how we get so caught up.
Man,
I've got to stay in these lines. And one of the things that our church, that I love about it, is that we really want to reach out to those people who have been burned by church or bored by church, one or the other, or people that are just completely mm-hmm. new to the faith. And so it's mm-hmm. most people, it's because of legalism. They've been caught in those pins. And you can't step outside of that pen. You can't look outside of that pen. You have to stay in there, or else you're crossing a real dangerous line, and we can't associate with you anymore. Yeah, the wild horse is mm-hmm. just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tony said something to me when we were talking. You know, he said talking about they're so afraid that, you know, people who leave the confines of an institutional church are going to fall into all kinds of heresy, and they're going to develop all kinds of false doctrines. And Tony told me, he said, you'll notice, and he mentions it in his book, he said, you'll notice that cults aren't started when a group of people get together and say, hey, let's discuss the Bible. And Jim Jones never told his people afterwards, well, what do you all think of that?
Mm-hmm.
There was no room for differing opinion. And we say, well, we don't do that in the institutional church, but we did an experiment that turned out to be so beautiful. The last church that I was at, this was a Baptist church real close to where I live. I think I'd been out of the institutional church long enough. I felt that, well, now things have changed. Now I can come back, and by now they must have gotten it. And so I went in and thinking, you know, that this would be the case. Well, guess what? It was still the same story. But anyway, I was involved in this church for a while and working with the youth, and the pastor, a younger guy, we'll call him Reverend Short. I'm not going to give his name, but he really thought he wanted to build community, because that's what he was talking about. Turned out later, all he wanted to do was build a $500,000, 300-seat sanctuary, which he finally accomplished. But I was opposed to it. But at the time, I thought, well, I want to help this. I want to build this church up. I want to help them grow. And so we started a house study on Saturday night with Nate and Tina and Greg and Monica, and this was going great. We would meet together. We would eat a meal together. We would study scripture together. It was there that I had read Tony Jones's book, Read, Think, Pray, Live, about Lectio Divina, quite a long time, which, if the listeners aren't familiar with that, is an awesome book. It's about the practice of studying a passage of scripture and meditating on it and praying it back to God and just letting God speak to you through that passage. It was in that study while we were looking at Matthew 18 about, you know, what you do when someone steps out of line. The last thing is you kick them out of the church. No, as we were meditating, the light came on in my head. No, Jesus treated publicans and sinners with love. And I couldn't find any commentary that agreed with me, and then I opened up Eugene Peterson's message, and there it was. He had caught it. He had understood that what Jesus was saying is when you've done everything you can to restore a person, a believer, and you still don't get anywhere, what do? You start all over and you start loving them even more. Mm. And that was an eye-opener for me. But as we were studying, we were meeting together, and we had others come and join us. And it got to where we had, I think, 14 adults and 15 or 16 kids, if you can imagine, in one house. And we realized, well, we've got to start other groups. We can't, we're getting too large. This is right. Getting out of hand. But we were loving it. We were growing. And so we invited the pastor and a couple of deacons in. Oh, boy. It hit the fan. The first thing that they noticed was we were doing communion together. We would take a loaf of bread and we would take the wine or the grape juice, whatever we preferred. And we were, as all kids and adults, we were all sitting down together. And the pastor refused to take communion with us. He said, "This is not right." I said, "Why not?" "Well, you can only do this when all the believers are present. You can only do this within the walls of the church." He said, "What are you going to do next? You're going to start baptizing in the bathtub?" And we looked at each other and said, "That's not a bad idea." And it was unbelievable. The venom that came. And he stood up in the pulpit that next Sunday and he said, "I encouraged this." He said, "Now I can no longer support it. I can't stop you from these groups. I can't stop them from meeting. But the church can no longer give their blessing to this." And it wow. effectively killed the study we had. We were scattered, and we still are friends. We still remember those, but one of the couples involved, they're involved as, the treasurer and the money aspects of the church. And I remember to this day a statement that one of the deacons made. He said, "Why do you people feel like you need to do this?" And we looked at him confused because we thought, "Need to do this? We want to do this. This is fantastic. We're opening mm-hmm. up to each other. This is koinonia. This is ecclesia. This is church. This is the body functioning. And we want others to share in this." And we said, "Well, because we love getting together, the fellowship." And I remember he looked at us and he said, "Well, as far as I'm concerned, if you're in church, whenever those doors are open, that's all the fellowship you need." I guess fellowship is a minimum daily requirement. And once you get the minimum daily requirement, right. you can't have any more because you might accidentally overdose.
It's like the FDA minimum requirement for vitamin C or something.
Right.
You just can't get over that and then your body just shuts down
right.
or something.
Exactly.
Wow.
And we were just stunned. And, we went our separate ways, but we still are getting back together every once in a while, but it's not the same. But what we have done is we are like... I don't know. I was thinking today as I was coming up, we always think in the Christian church today that bigger is better. The larger army, the more powerful army there is, the more impact it will have. But I got to thinking that some of the largest armies in the world, especially in some of the Bible stories, were defeated by some of the smallest things. And an army can be overcome more easily by a virus than it can sometimes by a show of force. And so I guess what we're these little viruses that have been sent out into our communities. And I admire people that go into like the big cities and the inner cities, and they're seeking to live this intentional community. And I think it's great. I think it's fantastic, and they need to continue doing that. But where the real need is for community is in these little, small Midwestern towns. where you think, you know, the days of Leave It to Beaver are still there. Everybody is happy. Ward and June Cleaver. Those are the places that have the most the lack of community and fellowship. Some of the harshest things that I have ever seen people do to each other have been in those small communities where you would think it would be the opposite. And if you think it is tough to live in a city, I challenge you to go live in a small Midwestern town and follow God in the way of Jesus, because you're looked upon as some kind of a strange radical, almost a cultist. Because why do you need, you know, why do you need to meet together? There's something wrong here. So, you know, both there are two Baptist churches where I live, 8 miles apart. Both of them have built 300-seat sanctuaries. Both of them now have about 100 people in them. Why did they need to build these sanctuaries? Because it isn't about, you know, getting people together. It's about putting on this impression. If we build it, they will come, was the philosophy that Pastor Short told me. And I thought, no, that's not right. That isn't where it's at. If we live it and love one another, then they will be drawn in. But, you know, how do you try and explain that when they have their mindset? Well, the other Baptist church, both in the same denomination, by the way, 8 miles apart, and they can't get along with each other. So, you know,
we don't have that in Texas. That never happens here.
Oh, no, I'm sure it doesn't. It never happens in Minnesota or anywhere else in the United States or the world, for that matter. But
right.
To see the people want to build this big building because the other church has a big building, I said no. And so I was on the hit list because I was on the building committee that was looking into this, and I said, well, I can see a multi-purpose room for about $60,000. And then when Pastor Short came with the plans, he had a 300-seat sanctuary and a $500,000 building project. And I said, this is ridiculous. So I was on the hit list. And, of course, you, being a very popular individual with the youth, I worked with the youth, and the high school kids loved me. They'd hang around me right there in the sanctuary, and they'd sit next to me. And I was informed by Pastor Short that I was a disruptive influence in the service, and so basically I was told I could come to church, but I had to sit in a corner by myself, in so many words. And
I see a real...
I'm a troublemaker. I am a radical. I'm a virus. I am. And you want to isolate the virus. I've only been computer literate for about a year and a half. By the way, I got to check out this Twitter. Sounds really interesting. Anyway.
We'll get you on there.
Okay. But anyway, this was I thought about it that night. And the next morning, I sent my letter in of resignation and said, I'm out of here, in so many words. And I've never looked back. Somewhere along the way, my brother-in-law, who we meet together regularly, he's in my Greek class, he and his wife and the guy that runs a hardware store there in town, he hooked me up with an individual named Frank Viola, who wrote a book called Pagan Christianity. And from there, I read George Barna's, the book that he wrote together, Revolution, Barna's book. And I realized that the hemorrhaging that is occurring in the church is not an isolated instance, that there are dedicated, committed Christians that are hemorrhaging out of the institutional church on a regular basis because they are seeking a deeper relational Christianity with God and with each other. They're seeking community, and they haven't found it in the pseudo community that exists in most organized churches. And one thing I want to stress, I believe that it can happen, and thank God for the institutional churches that are making a go of it. I you know, I don't believe the answer is to get rid of the institutional church altogether, because they are doing some things that are tremendous. But mm-hmm. by the same token, don't hunt down the free-range Christians and try to pin us up either. Because we have a purpose that God has put us here for. And if nothing else, it's to remind us that we were sent originally to roam free in this world and not to hole up in pens. So
it's great. I'm a huge fan of The West Wing, and very disappointed that the show went off the air a couple years back. But there's a line in there that I love. Anytime you start talking about small people or viruses or mm-hmm. revolutions or people changing the world, they say, never underestimate the power of a few people to change the world,
mm-hmm.
because that's the only thing that ever has.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look at it
and
this way.
That excites me.
Yeah, I look at it this way. I may not be able to change the world, but I can change the lives of individuals that I come in contact with on a daily basis. One example, this has been a blessing that has come back to me, I would say, a thousandfold. There was a young man, mm-hmm. I'll give his name, Andy and Karen Anderson. They were involved in one of the churches that I was pastoring in Oregon. They were a young couple, and they came in, and they were one of the couples that was growing. Andy was a rabid student of the Bible, and he loved to study. And he would come up to me, and he would ask me questions. And I had forgotten until 20 years. We lost touch with each other for 20-some years. And just recently, we hooked up again. He lives in Linden, Washington. And he told me, he said, one of the things that he just picked up from me was whenever he'd ask me a question, I'd always hand him the reference book and say, here, look it up yourself. Here, read it. Form your own opinion. And he said, that stuck with me. Well, he ended up becoming the sales manager of Logos Bible Software. And when he hooked back up with me, he told me about Logos, and I said, oh, my word. I said, you have no idea how I've been looking for, I've always considered the best thing I got out of my Bible college, and one of the reasons I never went to seminary was the books were the best thing that I got out of the whole deal. And the rest of the time, you know, there were valuable things that the professors taught, but my own independent study is what really got me excited. And when he told me about all the stuff that was available out there, I said, I want it. The only problem was I didn't have a computer. So this was about a year and a half ago, and Andy says, well, get a computer. And he said, I'll, and I looked at the books and I said, oh, this is perfect. This is perfect for a free ranger to get this.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, another friend of mine, I know most of you guys are Mac. I'm kind of joining the Mac club. Everyone at Solomon's Porch is Mac.
Don't give in.
I have an iPhone now. I have an iPhone, so I'm slowly being converted, all right? But my friend Larry was high up at Hewlett-Packard in Oregon. So I called him up, and I said, what do you got for me as far as a laptop? So he hooked me up with a laptop. I bought the software from Mandy, from Logos, and my word. I thought, there is no need for seminary.
Right.
this is fantastic. Well, then, right after that, a bunch of people in Maysville, my brother-in-law being one of them, and Harvest Darn, said, could you teach us Greek? And I said, you guys want to learn Greek? They go, yeah. I said, well, I can teach you what I know. And so then I get all this Logos software, and I'm like, oh, my word. Let's go to town here. And it taught me something very, very valuable, and that was the fact that we as pastors underestimate those people sitting in the pews. We think that they are incapable of learning anything beyond maybe the basic Bible stories, and so we package the message that we give to them. We package it in a little convenient three-point outlines with a poem and a prayer and a joke. Those are all, you know, you have to have all those mm-hmm. in there. And that's all they can handle. I realized when I got involved with these people and started teaching them, they were learning. And, I mean, an elderly hardware store owner, that he would pick up, he's become the star pupil. And there are insights he has gotten out of the scriptures. And because we have a format, there's anywhere from 4 to 10 of us that meet on Sunday when I'm not up here in Minnesota on a Sunday. We get together, we have no leadership per se. We open the scriptures and we share what God has done in our life throughout the week, and I realize that is what church should be. Church is not a place where we come and get ourselves charged up so we can run down during the week. During the week is where it happens, where we get charged up, where God works in our life. And then we come together once a week or however often, and then we discharge into each other. And I thought, what a reverse way of looking at things we've got.
Right.
I get charged up, and then I try to make it through the week. No, it's during the week that we need to look for the hand of God. It's during the week that we learn. And my word, to get out from behind a pulpit and not have to prepare a sermon, it has the scriptures have just come alive, and history, and I love just the learning part of it. It's just fantastic. And then the sharing, and then to get together with like-minded individuals and see how God has worked in their life. That is the body building itself up. Ephesians 4. For the longest time, I believe that Ephesians 4:13, can I get a little technical on you here? Do you mind? Okay. I don't know how much Greek you've had, but one of my favorite things about the Greek language is the Greek language will tell you by the use of whether it's an indicative or a subjunctive, and that's all I'm going to say. Indicative means something is going to happen. Subjunctive means something may or may not happen. It depends upon the involvement of the individuals. I looked at Ephesians chapter 4, verse 13. It says, until we all come to the unity of the Spirit. And that verb there, until we all come, is subjunctive. It means it's something that might not happen. And all this time, I believe that that verse was talking about that final day when Jesus returns and we are all united. Well, if that were the case, it would have been indicative in the Greek. And I thought, this is something that Paul is saying may or may not happen. He is allowing for the possibility that the last 2,000 years of church history may have been a struggle and a failure for us to attain the unity. The unity is something that we may or may not attain. It's dependent upon us. Wow. That changes the perspective a little bit. And I looked in the commentaries, and I thought, why is no one catching this? Why is no one making mention of this? Well, I think if you go back and talk to most people that have been in Bible school or seminary, a lot of times now it has become a case of micromanaging a corporation instead of using the tools. I mean, most seminary students get the basic elements of Greek and never use them again because they feel this is stuff above and beyond the level of comprehension of most of the congregations. I have found out firsthand that is not the case at all, that God gave the Holy Spirit to everyone, including those people sitting in the pews. The Bible was written by fishermen, not just all scholars. It was written by ordinary people, people that you wouldn't expect to stand in front of, you know, a seminary audience today.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, where do we get the idea now that the Bible can only be interpreted by specialists? I don't understand it. I don't understand it. Maybe it's because we've never seen Lectio Divina at work.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony, if you're listening to this, if you do, thank God that you wrote the book that you did, because even before I ever came to Solomon's Porch, before I ever met Tony, I read that book, and I realized every person has the Holy Spirit, we have the Word, and that is sufficient to get us, you know, deeper and closer together. And you don't have to be a professional. I mean, the more tools you add, obviously that's going to help in your study. But to say that only those who have received special titles, special robes that they wear and little overlays on the robes, those are the only ones that are qualified to teach Scripture, that is wrong.
Yeah. Frank, you're getting me fired up here. I may not be able to go to bed tonight.
Well, if you are awake, I'm going to plug somebody because, again, my brother-in-law John got me hooked on this. There are a couple of websites. Are you familiar with Wayne Jacobson at all?
I've heard the name. I'm not real familiar with him.
Wayne Jacobson has a blog or a podcast called The God Journey.
Okay.
He's also got a website called Lifestream. He is the individual that ran across William Young, the guy that wrote The Shack, and they're the ones that actually published The Shack when no one else would.
Okay.
I don't know if you've – I have it in my book bag, and I keep saying I'm going to read it and recommend it to everybody else, and they tell me how great it is, and I haven't read it myself.
I'm right about it. Your stack of three or four books. Including Tom Sine's new book that I'm just like, man, I got to read this, and something else comes up, and it gets pushed further down the stack.
I had somebody ask me about that, and I said, no, I'm not the one that recommended it to you, but I said, if you read it, let me know, because if it's good, I want to read it, add it to my list. So. But another individual that I ran across, he's kind of chums around with Wayne Jacobs, is a guy named David Fredrickson, and he's got a thing called Family Room Media. This is a guy that was in a church that was growing, and I think they were kind of a vineyard fellowship type church, just doing all the right things, hitting on all cylinders, and he just woke up one day and said, this is not what God said community should be. They disbanded the church, sold the church building, and became free-range Christians. And he has some of the funniest little short video clips that I have ever seen of, you know, tongue-in-cheek pointing out the foibles of how we operate sometimes in the institutional church. The funny thing is, as I watched them, they apply pretty much to every church that I've ever been involved in. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about where God has taken me, is I've had a chance to see that there isn't that much difference when you get right down to the basics. I mean, we may practice different baptismal modes. We may wear different hats behind the pulpit, but you get right down to the bottom of it. All of the groups that, you know, acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord and Savior are, that's all that there is. There is that unity there already. They just don't realize it. And they won't admit that the other person, because they baptize differently or look different, haven't got it down. So, just the divisiveness.
Yeah. I'm excited to publish this. The week before, we will have talked with Frank Viola, and so had a good chat with him.
Oh, awesome.
So one of the things that he points out, and I think you kind of touched on this as well, is I kind of asked him, I said, you know, after reading your books, one of the things that I felt, and then, you know, not necessarily critical about it, but I said one of the things that I felt disappointed about was I wanted to say, okay, how do I do this? How do I take this and put it into practice? And he said, well, I tried to touch on that, but in reality, it's almost like trying to tell someone what chocolate tastes like. You can't quite tell someone what it's like until they experience it themselves. And I think what you said was they think this is the only thing that there is because they haven't quite experienced that other side, and they haven't seen what it could be, and they don't know what it could be. And then, but once you get a taste of it, I think, like you've said, man, that's the only thing you want. That's the true free range, and you're excited, and you're gung-ho, and let's do it.
My friend Nate, who was in the house church thing that we were doing as a sub part of the Baptist church we were involved in, he has started a Bible study in his particular town, and the interesting thing is he's also teaching at the local Baptist church, teaching in the Sunday school, and he came up to me one day and he told me about the Sunday school lesson, and he was reading it to me, and this was Lifeway, came from the Southern Baptist denomination, and basically he was reading last week's lesson, and it said, if you start missing church, and if you're not in church on any given Sunday, you're opening yourself up for attacks from the devil, and pretty soon you'll fall away and you'll be gone. And I mean, about said everything except you'll lose your salvation if you are not in the walls of that building. And they put everything, you know, as being having to be within the realm of the walls of that building. And I couldn't believe it. I said, this is crazy. And the thing that most people notice when they take that step, if this is what God calls you to do, to step out and become a free range person, the first year or two, you feel like you are lost. I've gotten some feedback from individuals on the videos that I posted on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, it's Borromaeus 1 is my account name there on YouTube if you want to check
okay.
it out. A little plug there. But I have gotten truck drivers that have responded, and one guy shared the story of how he was asked to leave the church, and he said he felt dirty when he left. He felt like he had lost his salvation. He felt like they were he was being punished. And can we put this on hold for about 5 minutes?
Yeah, we can do that.
Or do you want to call back? Because the guy is here to open my doors.
Okay.
So I need to get that done. So
yeah.
Can I?
How about I give you a call back in about 10 minutes?
Just call me back. Yeah, just call me back in 10 minutes.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Frank.
Okay. Bye. Yes. Well, that little, interruption will show that we weren't making this up. I really am in my truck, and I really am being unloaded. The little interruptions.
Sure.
Just in case they thought this was all being done in a studio and we were faking it.
Exactly.
So, but anyway, where were we at?
You were talking about people feeling dirty after leaving the church and admitting that they just, it was hard the first year or two after leaving the church.
Yes, Dan, the guy that made this comment on my YouTube space, after he watched the video, he said that it wasn't but a week later he met the pastor of the church that kicked him out, and I guess they kicked the pastor out also, and he was pretty much feeling the same way. But he went to work at a nuclear power plant, and I believe his YouTube space now is Nuclear Dan or Nukem Dan or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He said in a second post that he put on there that in the time that since he has been kicked out of the church, he said that he has noticed the presence of God, witnessed more quote unquote miraculous things than he has ever seen when he was within the walls of an institutional church. And I was kind of surprised because I thought that parallels what I have seen in my life also. Not saying that God can't do wonderful things in the church, but when we limited him to 1 hour a week, obviously we aren't going to see all the tremendous things that God does. And it's almost as if we feel that God has done all the miraculous, wonderful things that he can do. There aren't any more coming because we aren't expecting any more.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do happen, we aren't given the opportunity to share it. Well, maybe 5 or 10 minutes for a little, praise reports or whatever. But I think it's the things that God is doing all the other days of the week that are the things that should be shared. And I really hope that more institutional churches plan their services, quote-unquote, around allowing people to share openly and to share the experiences. It takes time when you first start this because people are so hesitant because they feel that what they have experienced and what God has done in their life isn't worthy of sharing. But yet those are the very things that God may be putting in the body to help the body reach the next step of maturity.
Mm-hmm.
We've all been given the gift. We've all been given grace. We've all been given the share of the Spirit. And it is given so that we might share. I was just reading Hebrews where it talks about forsake not the assembling of yourselves together, which is I've been hit over the head many times with well, you're not in church on Sunday morning, so you're forsaking the assembling of yourselves together. But if you read the verses before and after that, it talks about provoking one another to love and good works. Mm-hmm. And if that's what it's about, any time two Christians meet, whether it's over coffee, whether it's on the bus or the subway, or just at the hardware store, and visit and share and talk about their life with God and what God has done, I believe that is that assembling happening. I remember in the institutional church, the thing that surprised me so much and shocked me, I guess, and disappointed me, was on Sunday morning we would have that usual time set aside for the meet and greet or whatever, and we would go around and people would come up to you and they would embrace you and smile and shake your hand and clap you on the back. Monday morning you would meet that very same person that had just told you, hugged you, and told you you'd run into them accidentally at the grocery store, and they'd look at you like a total stranger. They'd look at you like, who are you and what are you doing here and why are you talking mm-hmm. to me? And that kind of bothered me for a while, and then I realized, well, in a sense, they are meeting a total stranger. Because they're meeting someone they only know from one day out of the week for about a 5 or 10 minute session of shaking hands. The rest of the time, they're busy, you know, watching a screen, looking at an overhead, looking at the back of someone else's head. That is the extent of what occurs in a lot of the institutional gatherings. And it's sad. I was angered at first, but now I look at it more. Mm-hmm. I'm sad. I'm really grieved because I think, oh, I wish you could only see what yeah. you're missing out on. The joy and the growth and the fellowship and the love and the relational. And as you draw closer to each other, you draw closer to the Father. And that's the one thing that I have learned out of all of this, that through all of the experiences in my life, good and bad, he was there with me all the time, sharing those experiences. He may not have approved of everything I did, but yeah. he was there. We have this idea of God can't look at us. He can't have anything to do with us. The Greek concept of God, he's Zeus sitting up there with thunderbolts in his hand, ready to fire one our way whenever we do something wrong. But we forget that it was God that sought Adam in the garden after he sinned. He didn't say, nope, I'm going to put an office up in the corner of Eden somewhere, and I'm going to put office hours up there, and if you don't show up, I'm not going to have anything to do with you. He went and he sought Adam and Eve, even though there was sin. And that tells me that he is a God who, his love far outweighs any sense that he has of the repulsion of what we have done in our lives and what has happened to us. And I think Jesus pretty well illustrated that in his own life. We forget about these things, or we try to rationalize them away. I've come away from the impression, rereading the Gospels again, that not only did Jesus hang out with publicans and sinners, I think he liked them. He actually liked hanging out with them. And after my experience with some of the, quote, shadier people of mm-hmm. the world and of this life, I realize why that is, because of the honesty that they have. There's no sense of, we got to put on a false front. They're just open and honest. And what you see is what you get. And I think that's a good start for building the kind of relationships that God wants us to have with one another. But unfortunately, like was my case when I would take my family to church on Sunday morning, we would have a knockdown drag out trying to get ready. And I would disapprove of something my daughter would wear, or I would not like something that my wife had done. And so we would argue and bicker and we would fight. But the minute we hit the parking lot and the car doors opened, smiles, everyone. Yeah. It's like an episode of Fantasy Island.
Well, and then you put on that mask as soon as you walk in the door, and you have to act, holy and act like yeah. you're good enough. And then as soon as you get back out into the parking yeah. lot, you're wanting to flip everybody off that's cutting you off on the way to the exit.
It's on again, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And in our small town, it was a matter of you had to beat the Methodists to the cafe or they'd get all the fried chicken. And then you'd sit and glare at the minister and watch the clock, to make sure he didn't go over.
Yeah.
And the funny
here
thing
in Dallas,
is,
I was going to say, here in Dallas, it's all about you watch the clock to be sure that the passer doesn't go past kickoff time for the Cowboys.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, well, it's Chiefs country in Kansas City, so it's kind of the same thing there. But the funny thing is, this is what has really struck me as odd. The group of free rangers that we meet together on Sunday morning, we will go 2-3 hours sometimes. And one of the gals that is involved in our group, Sandy, her mother said to her one day, she said, "What are you doing out there? What do you do out there for so long?" And Sandy said, We fellowship, we visit, we talk about the Bible, we share our life, we share stories." And she said her mother had this expression like, "You're kidding," you know, because she thought it was 3 hours, 2-3 hours of what normally goes on in a traditional church service.
Mm-hmm.
And couldn't understand, well, for one thing, when you sit in a couch, you would think the tendency would be to fall asleep more easily, which really doesn't happen. I mean, if you put couches in the average institutional church service, yeah, it probably would make it easier for people to sleep. But when you're involved, when you're sharing, when you know that when you come there, people are looking forward to hearing what you had to say, what God did in your life that week, it makes all the difference in the world. All the difference in the world.
Excellent. Well, Frank, lot of lessons from you and a great story, and I'm sure that this is going to excite and inspire a lot of people just as it has me. So definitely appreciate you taking some time and talking with us tonight.
Well, I hope if nothing else, people realize that it isn't about the size of something. It isn't about the building. It's about meeting people one-on-one. And I hope, and I pray that, you know, those that are involved in institutional churches, that they don't, you know, leave just because of this, just because they feel they're frustrated. Stick it out, you know, try as you can. And when if God tells you to leave, know this, that there is a lot of support out there. God has given us the internet. He's given us, you know, things like this. We can keep in touch with each other, on Facebook, you know, people that I talk to, that I can encourage, and God is out here working, and, you know, the Shadow Fax is out here. He's just waiting for us to come into the field he's in so he can lead us into better pasture.
Awesome. Well, Frank, like you mentioned, you do have a Facebook page. You have the YouTube channel, Borromaeus. Are there other ways? That's at YouTube there. Are there other ways that people can get in touch with you?
my email, is it customary to give a phone number out? I really don't care if people know my phone number or not.
It's completely up
to you. I'm not a shit. All right, I do not mind. If someone wants to call and talk to me, it's 273-9594. 816-273-9594. And if they're experiencing a sense of there's nobody else out here that's gone through what I've gone through, I think we can compare stories and find out that your story may not be as awful as you think it is.
Yeah.
And that God hasn't abandoned you. He's been there with you, and he's preparing you for something fantastic.
Excellent.
I don't know if Thomas is listening or not. Just thank you to him for his encouragement that he's been in my life. Really enjoyed listening to him share. So,
well, we appreciate it, Frank.
Grace and peace to you guys, and yeah.
Yep, definitely.
Grace and peace to you, and just continue on.
Will do. Well, we hope that you have a safe night out there tonight, and safe trucking back to Missouri, and say hello to all of the friends there, your free rangers. And also to those folks there at Solomon's Porch, let them know that we're joining with them and seeking after Christ and following after Christ, and we're joining them in the celebration and the Supper of the Lamb.
I will do it. I'll tell you, the one of the best things that ever happened to me was when some of my friends at the bookstore told me about Solomon's Porch, because fantastic. I mean, I had just about given hope of ever finding a group of people that were open and real and honest, and thank God, I hope not that Solomon's Porch grows bigger, but that more Solomon's Porches grow up around the United States and the world, and I think they are.
Excellent. Well, Frank, you have a great night.
So, you too, Jonathan, and God bless.
God bless. If you have any questions or comments about this show, we do encourage you to drop us a line. You can email us somethingbeautifulpodcast@gmail.com or call our listener line 972-535-8980, 972-535-8980, or anywhere in the world if you're on Skype, simply Skype JD Blundell, and you can find a link to that right on our podcast page at www.somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.
Thanks for listening to the Something Beautiful podcast. Join us again next week at somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.